Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hi, folks. Hi. My great, great, great audience all over the world. It is so good to be talking to you again. I've had a very busy, hard couple of weeks. I don't know what that sound was. It wasn't from my end. But I've had a busy couple of hard weeks. And I'm just glad to be relaxing with you again instead of having a pre-recorded show. Things are good here. On my website, I just a little less than 5 weeks ago, started something that I've been looking forward to for a long time, which is a way of communicating whenever I feel like it with all the people who are interested in following what I'm doing as a part of what goes on in reform work in psychiatry. And I put up finally on my this new website that we developed over the past year, a frequent alerts that you can sign up for and get free, which will keep you up to date on not only what I'm doing, but on what a lot of other people are doing as well. I'm trying to include a range of activities in each relatively brief and snappily written alert. And to my great pleasure, by the time we reached our fifth alert, which was, less than a month, we had 5,000 viewers. So this is a really good beginning to something I've wanted to do for a long time. So go to Breggin.com, sign up, tell your friends about it, put it on your website. I'm hoping to keep these alerts coming at a very regular rate for the duration. It's one of the better ways I have to communicate. I'll be putting up one very soon, probably today, I hope all goes well. That's going to talk about a conference that I'll be co-hosting, really, in Raleigh in the week of July 25th. And I've invited Bob Whitaker to do a full-day workshop with me. It's going to be a really interesting conference based on not just my work, which is a piece of it, but it's really being done mostly by the William Glasser Institute. And Bill Glasser, when he was with us, was a friend and a fabulous psychiatrist who emphasized freedom and choice making as a part of psychotherapy. And he was also a very caring individual. So you'll learn about that upcoming conference. And then Canadian human rights advocate has sent me, and you can find out who he is when you go to it, sent me a important news item about what's going on in Russia. They're doing what they used to do back in the old Soviet Union, and the activist is Don Weitz, and I thank him for that and sending it to me. And what's going on in the old Soviet Union is coming back, which is psychiatry as an arm of political oppression. Well, I've sort of blathered my way through the opening today, and again, thank you for being with me. My guest today, I think he's there. Michael, you're there?
Yes, Peter, I'm here.
Doesn't he have a great voice, folks? This is Michael Cornwall. He's a part of my policy of having on the best and most beautiful more often. and he's been on a number of times before. And remember now, you can go to Bregan.com, look up the radio page, and find an alphabetical listing of all the past people and when they've been on the shows. This is not available anywhere else that I know of, not on the internet anywhere. Well, he's Michael Cornwall. Who is Michael Cornwall? Michael Cornwall is the genuine item. He's a genuine psychotherapist. He's a genuine reformer. He's a genuine person and human being. And he's all that despite having a PhD, which is quite an accomplishment, and despite years of grueling standing up to the establishment, Michael has really specialized in psychotherapy for people in psychotic states without resort to drugs, something I also do a great deal of. And he teaches at Esalen. He does workshops at Esalen. You can easily find him online. And one of the reasons I had him on today, although I'm always looking for an excuse, is that he has coming out soon a full journal by the Journal of Humanistic Psychology, a full volume on alternative transformative experiences, many of which other people call psychotic and so on. And in honor of that, I'm going to be having on three of the authors, and I'm one of those authors in this journal, which will be also available as a book. So just as I have celebrated the book, The Sedated Society, which has a bunch of great authors in it, I happen to be one of them, just as I'm trying to spread the word about the whole range of people in this field, I want to spread the word about Michael Cornwall's upcoming volume dealing with these things. And also just to talk to Michael about great stuff, his blogging on Mad in America. Hello, Michael Cornwall. How are you today?
Well, I'm much better. It's always wonderful to hear and to talk with you, Peter, and thank you for that wonderful introduction. I'm very excited about this special edition of the Journal of Humanistic Psychology that you wrote a great article for. Maybe we can talk some more about that in a minute. And it's going to be out online in a couple of weeks. But a little background on that for people who may not be familiar with that venerable journal. I believe it started in 1961 and grew out of the work of Carl Rogers and Abraham Maslow. And it's really been a guiding light, I think, for many decades around the values that you and I hold dear about humanistic approaches to people who are suffering. And so last year I was doing a workshop at the American Psychological Association in San Francisco, and the editor of the Journal of Humanistic Psychology, Sean Rubin, was there in the workshop. And I was basically doing a workshop training for caregivers, whether they're professionals or family members or peers, that I've been doing the last few years at Esalen and other places. And part of that involves an experiential exercise where I help us as caregivers focus on what's going on inside of us when we're with someone in an extreme state. And after that, I met Sean that day, his first day. And then after that, a few weeks later, he called me and said, "Hey, how would you like to do a special edition of the Journal of Humanistic Psychology on extreme states?" So, of course, that was great, a great opportunity that he offered. So, again, bless him, he just said, just go for it. You come up with the title for the journal. You find the authors. And he said, there's room for 20 people to write articles. And also he said, you know, if there's an overflow and it can't be contained in one journal edition, we'll have a second edition on this. So I just love it that this group of psychologists. He's part of that Division 32, you know, in the APA, that have been so instrumental in pushing back against a lot of the abuses of psychiatry. It's just wonderful that there's this interest in these alternative approaches to extreme states. So the title of the journal, special edition, is going to be Humanistic Approaches to Understanding and Responding to Extreme States. I'll just quickly say that several of the authors of the 20 have actually been on your program here. Bob Nickel and Yana Jacobs, I believe. Michael Guy Thompson and John Reed, great research on trauma from the UK. So also, which I think is maybe rare and unprecedented, is in this journal of 20 authors, Peter, 8 of us, including myself, will have actually had these experiences of extreme states. So people like Will Hall and David Lukoff and myself and several other people with actually who've been through these experiences and come out the other side will be writing articles.
That's really good. I'm looking forward to reading it myself. Now, people will be able to buy this as like a book independent of having to buy the whole journal?
Well, it's a special edition of the journal, and first it comes out online. And I'm working with publishers to where people can have a very reasonably priced access to it online. It should be out online within probably a couple of weeks, and it'll be available at ussagepub.com, ussagepub.com online. So there's, like a lot of these journals now, they have an online version, and then later in the year, there'll be a hard copy. So people stay tuned. My website's michaelcornwall.com. When it comes online here in a couple of weeks, I'll have information how people can download the whole special edition.
Well, that's great. That's great. It's interesting, folks, as I'm sitting here, I'm getting little red flashes, internet problems with my communication system, totally separate from me and from the studio with which I'm in constant instant message communicating. So if I disappear, Michael, if you don't hear me, keep talking. Your internet connection is probably unaffected.
Okay.
I wish you a lot of luck. I wish you a lot of luck with this. And let's go and talk some about perhaps what you think this is contributing. What are the ideas that you're seeing in here in this journal that are cutting edge or pioneering? I didn't prepare you for that question, so you can take a deep breath if you like. But what's new here? What's good here?
Well, that's a great question, and I think that's what Sean was hoping for and responding to. Also, that there are actually, and there have been for some time, but right now there's kind of a critical mass. You talked about your upcoming conference with Bob Whitaker. I think most people know he's the founder of madinamerica.com and has written these groundbreaking books, as you have, about the whole challenge to psychiatry. So right now at this time, and has been growing, you know, for decades, but there's a lot of people writing about alternative approaches to not only understanding what these extreme states are, but how they respond. And actually, just a little background information, people want to go to those archives and hear more about my story. I went through one of these processes that got us over 50 years ago now and came out through it without medication. So ever since then, there's been two questions in my mind. If what I went through and what the people I've served now since 1980 in these extreme states are going through, if that's not what psychiatry says it is, then what is it? What was it? And then if it's not what psychiatry says it is, then how should we respond differently? So that's really the heart of this journal. When I sent out the invitation to authors to write, those were the two questions I asked them to address in their own unique ways. if extreme states aren't what psychiatry says they are, what are they? And then if you don't believe they're what psychiatry says they are, then how can we better respond? So that's going to be the heart of this. And I think it's pretty obvious to you and me, but because we've been doing this work for so long. But I think for the general public and even for a lot of professionals, because the theory of the disease model of psychosis is so well accepted and bankrolled by the major universities and all the research on so-called schizophrenia. I mean, no one's written better than you have around debunking the whole disease model of psychiatry. So with that, against that backdrop, challenging that, I think it's really been incumbent on us for a long time to come up with an alternative causation model, an alternative explanation, so we can actually be there like I was, as you say, in the back in the day, not long ago, 28 years in the front lines of a public mental health system, over and over, having been in the room with a psychiatrist, turn to someone and say, you have a brain disease. You will have to take these meds for the rest of your life. It's something like diabetes. And I raise my hand and say, excuse me, I think there's a different approach, a different version of that. And I would come up with an alternative explanation. But you know, families and people who go in to get for help, they're hurting, they're afraid, they're in need of that care of the licensed psychiatrist they believe is going to help them. And so when they are told, you have, this is what's wrong with you, this is what's going on, they believe it. So for us to come up with a, you know, something, an explanation on a 3x5 card of no, there's another explanation that's going on that you and I have been talking about for years, and John Reed, I think, has really contributed about trauma, about loss, about you know, early childhood adversity. So if we come up with that alternative explanation of why it happens, then it's easy to say, okay, then how should we respond? And that gets into your work on empathic therapy. So that's, you can tell I've got energy about this. It's been a long time that I've been frustrated with the so-called, you know, mental health reform movement who've really hesitated to come up with a cogent alternative explanation. I know there's a lot of reasons for that, but I'd like everyone who, you know, talks about overthrowing psychiatry to have be able to say that we have an alternative theory to challenge theirs.
Yeah, let me talk a little about some of my my current thinking about it. And the therapeutic approach differs a great deal from the more abstract concept about what's happening to the person, but they're also closely related. I think, first of all, that people in extreme states are extremely vulnerable.
Yeah.
And being so vulnerable, they need to be treated with care, kindness, thoughtfulness, restrained love and affection, but very restrained, because that can scare somebody who's very vulnerable. They need be listened to the extent they can communicate. So the whole approach has to be one of, in a sense, the helper being vulnerable, the helper being available, the helper not hiding behind a suit or a bunch of plaques on the wall or authority. So I think it's a person-to-person protected environment that is the starting point. And most people in extreme states who come at least for help are quite frightened and beleaguered in their extreme states. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. And what you just said there is spot on. In fact, that's the second part of this inquiry. How then can we best respond? And actually, that's what I mainly focus on in these trainings I do that I, like I said, that psychiatrists, psychologists, caregivers come for is how can we as the caregiver, like you say, shift the focus not so much on leaning forward and analyzing what's going on with the person and running everything they say through the, you know, the black box of the psychopathology model, but how can we shift inside? Actually, in three ways, this is what I help people focus on, is how are you, the caregiver, be able to be present, really physically, in your body, especially in the face of someone who's in a lot of emotional pain, maybe is agitated? How can we, when we're in the presence of someone who's in intense emotional experience, how can we physically keep breathing? How can we physically feel, you know, our feet on the floor? How can we do that? How can we then also cognitively kind of turn off, like you say, that analytical problem-solving mind that tends to ask a lot of questions, which is usually the last thing someone in an extreme state wants to happen, is to be grilled by someone. And then how can we find, you know, in our emotional state, like you say, an appropriate heart-centered caring, to where the person looks at us and they actually see empathy and compassion in our eyes, instead of, I wonder what's really wrong with this person. You know, that versus, you know, the caring, empathic response that you've written so much about, versus the detached clinical assessing. I think that's enormous. And I must say, when I do these trainings, that every time there'll be psychiatrists or psychologists, when I do this experiential part, will respond like, wow, I just realized how hard it is for me to turn off my computer in my head and stop analyzing people, you know?
It is. It's hard for us to get out of the intellect. One of the things that I think is so important, relates to all this, is the issue of trust. How do you encourage somebody to feel a modicum, a little bit of trust, when they have usually been abused by past events and probably by psychiatrists, and thus it's a first time episode and they have never been in treatment. The building of trust, I think, is a matter of first just appearing like a caring human being who is right there to help you and offer you a cup of tea or a glass of water or a snack if you look hungry, somebody who's just willing to break down the barrier of authority as much as possible and to build trust rather than authority. If you have those things in mind, those intentions, it can help a great deal. Being welcoming. Right at the start of sessions, if patients have been through any kind of psychiatry, I start out by saying, you can tell me anything you want, and I'm not going to lock you up, and I'm not going to give you drugs, let alone increase your drugs. If you're on them, I won't increase them, and I'm certainly not going to start you on drugs. So it's safe to share your feelings with me. And the only potential breach in that would be the duty for me to warn if you were, in imminent danger to somebody. The law requires me to warn or take some action, but I'm never going to commit you to a mental hospital. And people are reassured by this. I've never had anybody say, don't commit me, for God's sakes. I need to be committed. The closest I've ever come to that was a woman who I'd never met, who had just come to town, and I don't know what the circumstances were that I saw her. It was many years ago, before Ithaca, back in D.C. She had no friends in town, and she ended up in my office was throwing things around and sprinkling cologne. And I said to her, please stop. You know, you're going to harm things. What are you doing? And she said, I'm trying to show you that I need to be hospitalized. And I said, well, that's okay. You could have asked. Certainly, it's very possible for you to be hospitalized. You're not capable of driving over there. May I call the police to take you over to a hospital, because I certainly am in no position to take you over there? And she said, yes, do that. Yeah. And I called the police, and they took her over to the hospital. She admitted herself voluntarily, called me back sometime later to thank me, but never called me again. So people don't generally want to be forced into anything. And she wasn't asking to be forced. She was being asked, hey, would you just be a caretaker and see that I get in the hospital? So people are relieved when I tell them I don't involuntarily hospitalize anybody and that I don't start people on drugs or increase their drugs, because they're telling me very frightening or scary things, including their suicidal feelings. So I think that helps a lot. What's your own thinking on that?
Well, I think that's right on about trust, and even in that unusual example of someone wanting to trust you to get them to the hospital, you know, because of your empathy and your caring, that rapport was established. And it reminds me of something that that happened a few months ago. Maybe I can quickly tell about that. I think for me really captures that whole experience of someone who hasn't been trusting, who's been very withdrawn, feeling, or as Lang used to say, our willingness to be harmlessly helpful, you know.
I love that.
Yeah, me too.
That's
and,
good.
There was a family that contacted me. They didn't live close by, so I couldn't see them in person, but their son was in their 20s, had been hospitalized several times, as we know that cycle. When aren't these places like Open Dialogue or iWard or Iavis or Soteria for a person to go through? They usually get in that revolving cycle of hospitalization, get out, won't take the meds, then rehospitalization. Well, this young man had been through that several times, and the family was demoralized, and he was really pulled back into himself. In fact, the parents reported that, you know, they didn't want him to take him to the hospital again, but they were at a loss because he hadn't spoken a complete sentence in 3 months. He'd been so isolated, just kind of wandering around the house in a daze. So I said, well, you know, I've never done this before with someone in that condition, but if you queue up the Skype, I'll be there on the Skype screen, and if he's in the room, maybe, you know, I can connect with him somehow. So the parents put up the Skype on the, you know, the iPad, and it was there, and he could look over, and I saw him come over. He was wandering around with no shirt on, and he kind of peered in at me, and I was sitting there smiling with him, just trying to establish some kind of connection. Like, I'm a human being. I'm not going to start asking a bunch of questions. I just said, hi, my name's Michael. I'm glad to see you. And 5 minutes went by, Peter, and then he'd come back and look in. And then he'd go away. And I would sit there, you know, because I've done this a lot. Sometimes I'll be with people for a whole hour, and I won't say anything while they're either talking or not talking. Anyway, this went on for almost 45 minutes. He'd come and he'd go. And then at one point he came and he peered in at me. And as he was doing that, kind of unbidden from the feeling I was having for him, the words came to my eye. I know you this know this saying, you are the apple of my eye. That came to my mind. I didn't speak, but when I was looking at him, it just came out. So I was looking at him with that appreciation, you know, that we can give to each other sometimes. And he went away and came back. And then he looked in and he said, so what do you get off on? He asked me. In other words, what do you like to do?
And that's a great invitation he gave you.
Yeah, it was. And so I...
Did you tell him? In the dark. Did you tell him?
No, I did. And of course, that was kind of a young person's, you know, hip language. What do you get off on, old man? You know, but immediately I found myself saying, oh, I really love nature. And I love to go out every day down by the river where I live. And I like to see the clouds. I was aware later that I was kind of trying to draw him into a sensory world, kind of draw him out of his world into part of mine. And I said, I love to see the clouds. And I love the smell of the river. I love hearing, you know, the birds go by. And I said, and I really love meeting new people. And we started then Skyping regularly for the next few weeks. And pretty soon he was asking me questions about movies, and we're talking about movies. And he just kind of really needed that, someone to, you know, quietly, like you say, with trust, building that trust. And he was able to get hooked up with some good people in his area, you know, to have some contact face-to-face. And that's a very dramatic example. And I just think it really highlights how when we're in that open, caring place, sometimes that's that harmlessly helpful place, like Lang said, can make a world of difference.
Yeah, I like so much of what you're saying. Let me ask you about sitting quietly. I haven't done that in decades because I'm always concerned that if I let 5 or 10 minutes go by without saying anything with someone whom I don't know I don't know how to tell if someone's comfortable with that unless they can tell me they'd like to sit quietly for a while. So tell me your experience with that. I would be tempted if someone was just sitting quietly to find a way to have them talk with me, or I might say, well, let me chat with you for a while and tell you some of my thoughts, and maybe you'll find some worth in that. So tell me about that, about the sitting quietly for a long period of time.
Yeah, that's a good question. It's one that I question myself almost every therapy session I do. When do we ask a question? When do we engage? When do we wait? I mean, I think that's a classic almost dilemma for us. My experience with some folks in these extreme states, it's almost like my intuition tells me, especially people who have been hounded by mental health professionals, that like with this young man, my intuition just told me with him that, and I think I was getting feedback too when he kept coming back and looking in to see me, that if I just sat there quietly with him, that was what I should be doing. A session or two later with him, I had the exact opposite. Like, well, I need to really be verbally engaging him. So I think it's hard to know. I think that's just one of the things we has wrestled with as therapists. But I think sometimes our intuition can kind of help us, you know. And it's tricky with people who are in extreme states. I've had people who are in extreme states actually say to me, are you just going to sit there and not say anything? You know, so then, okay, my intuition was wrong. I wish I had a better answer, Peter, but I think it's just one person at a time.
Well, I think I probably err in the opposite direction, where on occasion people might say to me, okay, this is what I want to talk about, or something like that. But I always tend to fill up voids because I'm afraid it looks that it makes people anxious to not be communicating. You know, we know the old analysts, when they didn't communicate with people, it made them crazy, and it resulted in, quote, regression over time, where vulnerable people actually just got disturbed coming in every day because it was 5 days a week or six, the old analytic model, and being with somebody who didn't talk to them. But I'm more likely to do small talk. I might, by agreement, you know, well, you know, I somebody in the States, I might clearly just want to small talk with me about the weather or their ride over or the politics or something else. But then I always then remind them that I also would like to, you know, maybe we could talk some about the hallucinations that are terrifying them at the moment, or talk about just what they're planning on doing tomorrow or tonight or something along those lines. So I suspect that our sessions look different quite a bit, but not the basic attempt we're making to be caring. I think that's where this empathic therapy idea, I think, is so grounded, so good, because the rock is a caring relationship. Does that make sense to you?
Absolutely. And and there again, what you were saying, sometimes asking or talking about very seemingly to, you know, the busy psychiatrist, very mundane things like you know, what the person's, you know, going to do after the meeting, or you know, just I think there's a way when we try and enter someone's world in a caring way, whether it's an extreme state or not, that in a way they're wanting to share what's going on with them with us. So, you know, any way we can help that happen at their pace, And I can't imagine you ever, you know, trying to draw something out of someone who was clearly kind of like digging in their heels and going, I don't want to go there, you know. So it's
I would never want to do that.
So I often, sometimes the sessions that I have are just kind of that chatting for the whole time. And I mean, there again, people report, wow, you know, I really haven't had anyone to just talk about the things I like to do. No one ever seemed interested in that, you know. It can be very good.
Well, people in extreme states are usually very isolated and very lonely. They sometimes live alone. They may have some disability. They may not be working. Or they may be, nowadays, you get lots of people in their 20s loaded up on psych drugs. They're living at home. And we may be the only person they get to actually have any sort of safe or meaningful relationship with. And in some cases, they may not have really spoken to other people when they're out in the world. Let's say they've done a little shopping. They may have been very frightened during the shopping. Not talk with anyone. So it's important for people to understand that what looks like bizarre behavior and frightening behavior, I mean, it's almost always scared behavior. It's almost always a behavior where trust is shaken and people are suspicious and frightened. Relationship has been destroyed in their lives. Now, moving more toward what's going on with folks. I mean, it's been interesting to share with you. As more of an activist, I'm likely at some point to say is to somebody, well, you know, that's like a nightmare you're describing, and you've told me you've had similar nightmares to all these threatening and terrifying things in your life, and it might help you to view this as a waking nightmare with a lot of elements from all that abuse you went through. Mm-hmm. Now, would you do something, say something direct like that? Would you even agree with it? I don't know.
No, absolutely. I've many times said something because I think like that. Because I think, again, it's not only the the professionals that need to understand what's going on. But, you know, I remember when I was in my own experience, you know, 50 years ago, that was part of the agony of it, is I didn't know what was happening. I mean, the world had shifted from the normal, you know, high school, college world to all of a sudden I was in this nether world. And to have someone I wish I had then be able to kind of hold out a roadmap and go, things have happened that have caused you to be in this state, and it adds up. In fact, sometimes, Peter, I end up saying something similar to what you do. It's almost like I'll say, oh, from what you're telling me more and more, it really makes sense that right now you would be in this kind of waking dream state. And the person goes, they'll often say, yeah, it feels like a waking dream. It's like, what's going on? And so there's that disorientation going on that sometimes I think we can help kind of hold up a bit of the roadmap of which involves confirming without pathologizing, just, oh, yeah, this is happening for you. And I'm familiar with this happening for people. This is, because I think there's that sense of such a disconnect of one's life before, and then when people are in the extreme states, it's very bewildering.
I shared, as an example of this, I shared an recent experience of my own with one of my clients, one of my favorite people in the world, actually. And I had been happily snoozing next to my wife on a couch watching a Hallmark romantic movie, which we find really just comforting to watch quite often. And I just fell asleep. And I woke up to a scream, which one rarely hears on a Hallmark movie, a loud scream as a woman who was taking photographs in the movie, a woman taking, didn't seem like a movie when I woke up, woman taking photographs in the movie, fell through the railing on the dock and was abruptly immersed underwater. So I woke up to this big screen, you know, high-def TV in our little room that we're watching it in, to total immersion underwater, drowning, and I screamed. I didn't, out of coming out of this, and I didn't know what was happening. It was like a nightmare to awaken to that, and then it took me a few seconds and seeing my wife beside me looking at me like, whoa, what's happening? What can I do? And when I explained that confusion between reality and unreality and a nightmare, which this wasn't, I think it helped, if nothing else, communicate that I kind of understood what a confusing, terrifying world some of these alternative states are, some of these extreme states are.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's any way we can build those bridges where what the person's going through, we're kind of sharing that humanity with them. Again, especially for people who have been diagnosed and given the prognosis and really been, it's almost like a medical curse, I think, sometimes. A lot of people come to see me who've been through the mill. I still see people in acute states sometimes. A lot of people come see me who, you know, been diagnosed and on meds. And I always support anyone who feels like the meds are helping them. But I also know that when just as damaging as some of the effects of meds might be, that almost medical curse of their pathology, their lifelong loss of hope that they're given. I think when we can give a completely, again, back, I'll just say it the third time, Lang's kind of harmlessly helpful. It's like, I think Lang talked quite a bit about that. Like, no, I'm just like you. I may not have had these extreme states yet, but it doesn't mean I may not be capable of them. I remember one psychopathology professor I had in grad school when I was talking about some of this in the class. She got pretty defensive, Peter, and she said, "Well, Michael, I just want to go on record and say that because of my training analysis and my ego strength, I could never go into an extreme state." And that kind of hubris, you know, kind of born of ignorance, and I just kind of, all the class turned and looked at me, and I said, "Well, for your sake, I hope that's true." But I work with a lot of people in their 50s. Yeah, go ahead.
I just had this spontaneous, that had been my spontaneous response would have been a little smile and, "I'm sorry."
Sorry you missed out on that depth experience.
Never had an extreme state. A lot of people who've never had extreme states are actually jealous of people who have, because these can be remarkably, and this is an important topic for us to move to. And a lot of people find that extreme states are the beginning of some dramatic change. In fact, I'm going to do an alert about that in the next week or two, how there's a growing awareness in the field of helping veterans get over terrible PTSD, which often is an extreme state with hallucinations, delusions, paranoia, but it's all from trauma. How they can be growth events. So perhaps would you like to take off on that? Was it a growth event for you?
It was. It was like most initiations, there's no guarantee that the initiate will survive it. So for me, it was very harrowing. I know for a long time, my main mentor was John Perry, who had been in Zurich with Jung, who Jung went through his own trial. We can see that in his red book and in his autobiography. So I liken these often to potential kind of shamanic, modern urban shamanic initiations. That's why these sanctuaries that like Diabasis and I Ward, where we let people go through them, are so important. Because if it's really viewed as this initiatory process that, you know, as Carl Menninger famously said, people can come out the other side weller than well. And I think Lang talked about that. Perry certainly did. So, you know, there's the whole spiritual emergence movement. And I think, again, how it's framed, how it's held, how it's described, if it's seen as a necessary purposive transition that someone's going through, I'm talking about not only the first acute encounter, but even later, after those sanctuaries closed for the next 25 years, I worked in that public mental health system with a lot of people who were so-called beyond hope, you know, who had been in the system for years. And that same heart-centered approach, Peter, of being with people, meeting them where they are, often it was under the bridge. I worked with a lot of homeless people. That process that they were going through, again, is kind of a Jungian approach. I believe there's always that archetypal or spiritual level to our beings and what's going on. So I think that's part of what drives it. And then there's just the healing from trauma, just the help that we need when we're trying to heal from trauma. So, yeah, I think it can be. I mean, everyone I've known, you know, like our friend Daniel Fisher, the psychiatrist, a lot of these people that are going to be writing in this Journal of Humanistic Psychology, like Will Hall, Cardam Harnum, you know, David Lukoff, they talk about these experiences as life-changing experiences that enrich their lives. But there again, not everybody survives them. So I think it's rare that someone, I think, would encourage everyone to go through one of these. That I wouldn't encourage that.
I don't think our encouraging it or not encouraging it would change much, because these things are experienced as usually overcoming people, not by their choice.
Yeah.
I'm sure you agree with that.
They're
overwhelming.
Yeah, and sometimes some people are seeking these initiatory experiences through different mind-altering substances, and bless them, you know, if they have these life-transforming experiences. But there's no guarantee there either. If people take certain psychedelics, it's kind of rolling the dice there. You're right. The people who go into them without hallucinogens, I mean, that's part of the model, is that this was something someone had to go through to get to the other side. But I just don't want to ever romanticize the experience. I think it can be very harrowing and, like you say, terrifying.
I think that's a very good caution. Increasingly, in recent years, I'm seeing more of what I saw back in the 60s when I was doing therapy. I went into practice in 66 and was in psychiatric residency before that, so I saw a lot of the 60s. I'm seeing people who became psychotic on psychedelic or other mind-altering drugs and have had trouble recovering. And there's more and more reports in the literature that marijuana can cause psychotic experiences, and I know that from being a therapist and also having friends, that can happen. And it can harm the person gravely. So I am myself 100% against altering your brain with anything. And I'm not even sure which is more dangerous, the causing an extreme state with your own chosen drugs or with psychiatric drugs. I mean, doing that much harm to the brain, because it has to harm the brain. That's what causes the effect of the psychiatric drug. That's what causes the effect of the hallucinogenic drug. It's changing the brain chemistry and with the potential of a permanent, irrevocable harm. So I'm so glad you brought that up as a part of this discussion. I don't think that it helps to stop somebody in one of these states with a drug either. I think that the most best way that I have in private practice of helping people get through these states is with their families. People, especially teenagers who go through these experiences, people in their 20s. I mean, I recently helped a person through a rather severe manic episode without drugs, but with enormous help from one member of her family. Who kept her company and helped keep bringing her back to reality and calming her down. So it's also untrue that you can't help people in a manic episode without drugs. I mean, it's just that we don't have the proper conditions to do it. Do you see any greater hope now than a year or two ago for are again having the kinds of havens that were being developed decades ago?
Yes, I do, and I have some good news from San Francisco. We're actually trying to get one of those going. It looks like a serious possibility. And here I am in San Francisco, so I have an open mind. I'm not disagreeing with you about the risks of different substances. I've seen people who had really difficult reactions that they dealt with for years from different hallucinogens. I think the whole question of medical marijuana and even some of the research that's going on with MDMA and LSD for PTSD again, I'm not willing to say that that's a mistake. I think some people have really benefited from it. So I know veterans who have PTSD report help from medical marijuana. I'm concerned when people, again, may not understand how powerful some of those drugs are and take them. And it's very true that the strains of marijuana these days are a lot stronger than they were back in the 60s. You know, about the upswing in places that, you know, Michael Guy Thompson, I guess, is going to be on your program next week. He's spearheading a great group here in the Bay Area to open what's called the Knossos Retreat Center, knossosretreatcenter.org. And there's a bunch of us working with Michael around that to open a place in San Francisco where people can go and have a haven. Peter, how tragic is it that we know places like Diabasis and I Ward and Soteria, they diverted so many people from being in the mental health system. The Agnes Project research shows at least 2/3. Right now, today, if those kind of programs were there in every town, 2/3 of the people who are in the mental health system, I believe, according to the research, wouldn't be in the system. They would have gone through what they needed to go through, again, talking about the purposeless of it. So open dialogue is really booming, isn't it? You know, we see now a lot of money being put into open. So that's good news. You know, there may be a real challenge to the one-size-fits-all medication for all psychiatric model.
Yeah, open dialogue, folks. Bob Whitaker's done a lot to publicize. I've written about it, and you can just simply Google it, open dialogue, in Finland. Maybe it's the medical doc in me, God forbid, but I think the use of drugs that are psychoactive, I think that the risk-benefit ratio is just very, very lopsided. And medical marijuana, I know marijuana can sedate people and calm people. It can make other people disturbed. Most people, I think, though, are going to lose something smoking dope for months or years. So I'm really concerned about that. But Michael Cornwall, thank you, as always, for being on the show. We're drawing to the end. To me, you are just a shining light in our broad, broad field of people trying to help people. And I just thank God for your existence, my friend. Thank you for being on the show again. You have a parting thought?
Well, I just want to express my gratitude to you again. And I'll just say again, when I was out there in the 70s and 80s, to have your book and your message that no one other than Thomas Sasz and a few people are making. Anyway, you helped us all. Thank you.
Thank you. Michael Cornwall, folks, a really genuine helper of human beings. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Peter. Bless you.